I'm going to read two passages from the Hebrew Bible on the topic of holy living. Both of them start with a question. How can I be pleasing to God? That may be the question we bring to church, too. How do we become good people? Here are a couple of lists for behaving in a way that brings delight to God. The first is from one of the shortest Psalms in the Bible. This contemporary translation puts it in a language most of us can relate to. Psalm 15, the message. God, who gets invited to dinner at your place? How do we get on your guest list? Walk straight, act right, tell the truth. Don't hurt your friend, don't blame your neighbor, despise the despisable. Keep your word even when it costs you. Make an honest living. Never take a bribe. You'll never get blacklisted if you live like this. Did you notice that the answer to how do we make God happy is to treat others with kindness and respect? The next reading from the prophet Micah really brings that home. It starts with a long list of religious and ritual acts that are supposed to appease God. But God cuts through all of that with a single sentence about justice, kindness, and humility. With what shall I become before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?
It's so good to be back. For those of you who might be new, I am back. There was a time when I was here for a good long time while John was on sabbatical. So lots of you are familiar to me, and it's great to be back and see, be worshiping not across the street, but here in this beautiful sanctuary with that fabulous organ. And it's great to be back working with Bob and Vicky.
Let me introduce you to this.
Oh, thank you. I don't have to stand on my tiptoes. Ooh, look at now I'm in my power. And anyway, so thank you for inviting me back, and I will see you again, I hope, in another month. Our reading this morning is from the sports page of the local newspaper. The holy text was opened, and the lesson for the day was read. Blessed are the strong, for they shall make it to the Super Bowl. Blessed are the quarterbacks, for they shall be adored. Blessed are the champion athletes, for they shall command salaries in the millions. Blessed are the season ticket holders, for theirs is the privilege of gloating. Blessed are you when you wear the Super Bowl ring, for you shall be considered a hero forever. Here ends the reading. Now, I think that's a pretty good approximation of what our culture considers valuable and blessed. In fact, the events of the last year have pretty much summed it up. It's all about winning. We aspire, above all things, to be winners. We revere winners. It wasn't much different in Jesus' day. Power, fame, wealth, and triumph in competition, they were all valued in that period of the Roman Empire. And as for religion, it didn't help much either. In another parallel to today, one of the core teachings of Jesus' own religion was that wealth and success and good fortune were evidence of God's blessing. So, unlike what I read you from our newspaper, the biblical Beatitudes are a real text for today. If they sound strange to us in the 21st century, they were perhaps even more alien to Jesus' contemporaries. Can you imagine the ragged, hungry peasants who gathered around Jesus, scratching their open sores and listening to him speaking this nonsense? This is from Matthew 5. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. That's the good news that Jesus preached from a little mountaintop a long time ago in Palestine. And these Beatitudes we consider to be at the core of our faith. Volumes have been written to interpret them. But how much interpretation do they really need? They say what they mean. The problem is they don't make much sense, do they? I've lost a page. I'm a manuscript preacher. If I lose a page, I'm lost. Ah, there we go. They don't make much sense. You know what? You can squeeze meaning out of them if you believe that suffering will be rewarded in the afterlife. But you know what? That isn't the intent. When Matthew uses the word heaven, your reward will be in heaven, he doesn't mean the hereafter. He means your reward will be of God, from God. Matthew practiced that Jewish taboo, which continues to today, of never writing the name of God. So heaven is code for the realm of God. Great is your reward in God's economy now. A friend of mine commented on the many posters he's seen of the Beatitudes, beautifully written in calligraphy against a sunset. He said, you know, that's completely wrong. This is a subversive message. The Beatitudes should be scrawled in graffiti on the dark walls of alleys or on railway bridges. The Beatitudes tell us that God's favor abides with the meek, the mourning, the poor in spirit. Now, to some of us, this will not come as a surprise. We know this because we have experienced it. A friend of mine wrote, "My personal beatitude came out of the worst period of my life, and it is this. Blessed are you who have lost someone you love, for then you will truly know what love is." She found a depth and compassion from God when her husband died. The famous preacher, Harry Emerson Fosdick, dated his rebirth from his nervous breakdown. He became more effective as a pastor when he no longer depended on himself but trusted God, because he could not rely anymore on his own capabilities. So yes, we can find ourselves in the Beatitudes. But we also know that there's another level of meekness and mourning and desperation of spirit that deserves our attention. We've seen those desperate ones reviled on our television screens. We've watched their bodies lie wounded in the streets. We've seen them blown away by terrorist attacks. We can't escape images of them carrying bleeding children as they seek refuge from war. We drive by them as they hold up signs at the Fresh Pond intersection. These are the beloved ones who are close to the heart of God. The Beatitudes are about statement of a compassionate God who pours love and blessing on the nobodies and the sufferers. The Beatitudes are about God's preferential option for the poor, as the liberation theologians would have it. This is the kind of God I want to believe in, and do believe in. This is also the kind of God who calls me to do the same. I love this passage in Matthew. First, Jesus takes this improbable list of underdogs, and he blesses them, and then he tells them to flaunt it. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything but be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You're the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, hides it under a bushel basket, but puts it on a lampstand, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they can see your good works and give glory to your Father, Mother, who are in heaven. It's a little ironic. You could understand it if Jesus were talking about the powerful Church of Constantine or about the bishops that controlled kings and nation states in the Middle Ages, but no. Who does he call the salt of the earth? The light of the world. Exactly those meek and downtrodden ones, the laborers, the street people, the slightly shady IRS agent, the meek, the mourning, the poor in spirit, the persecuted, and the walking wounded. That's really very good news. It gives us no excuse. If these ragged peasants can be named the light of the world, how can we not answer, "Me too, me too"? Are we any better prepared? Any less wounded? Any more moral? We might be richer in things, and probably we're not meek. But are we any more suitable to be disciples? Probably not. These words are for us. They send us out into our daily living to be Christians in a social context. Being salt and light, as Bob told the kids, is about relationships. John Wesley says, Christianity is a social religion. To turn it into a solitary religion is to destroy it. The Christian faith is not practiced in church. Church is where we are prepared for the actual living of the Christian life. Church is where we come together to allow God to heal us, encourage us, and remind us that we are blessed, so that for one more week at least, we are ready to be salt and light. It was that dread weekend of the daylight savings time shift, and a young church member arrived just as the congregation was leaving. How many of us have had that happen? Oh no, I'm late, he said, the service is over. No, replied a woman coming out of the door, it's just beginning. Now we're going out to do it. So let's be conscious of our humble calling this week. We don't have to do big things. Jesus didn't say, you are the earthquake, the storm, the blinding flash of lightning. Jesus is not asking for drama, for the grand gesture. No, you're salt and a candle. Just necessities, a metaphor for the integration of faith with daily practice. Remember, tears are salty. Perhaps we need do nothing more than cry with a friend. Or will we bring a bit of light by calling someone on the phone or enhance the flavor of the lunchtime conversation? By questioning the dehumanizing atmosphere in our office, or joining with multitudes of friends, just one person, making up quite a group at all the demonstrations that are happening. And let's not forget that blessed gift that people of faith bring to the world. The gift of prayer. That is an offering of light we can make every single day. That darkness might seem very dense now. What can be done to shed a little light? Well, we have our recipe. Eliza read them for us. You can go back to those texts if you need them. God has told you, mortals, what is good. Do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God.